Hi, and welcome to Prosody, WYEP's weekly show featuring the work of poets and writers. I'm Jan Beatty, and my guest tonight is the poet Maxwell King. Maxwell King came to Pittsburgh 6 years ago to become the president of the Heinz Endowments, one of Pennsylvania's largest charitable foundations. In addition to his work at the endowments, he serves on a number of local boards and committees. Before coming here, he was the editor of the Philadelphia Inquirer and spent over 30 years working for newspapers and magazines. He did not start writing poetry until after he left journalism. He has published in half a dozen literary periodicals, including 5 AM, Tar River Poetry, Confrontation, and the American Poetry Review. Hi, Max. How are you?
Hi, Jan. Thanks for having me.
You're going to read from a manuscript in progress, as yet untitled.
Right.
Okay.
Right. I thought I would start out with a poem that I've called Nocturne, and a number of people whose judgment I trust have advised me that I need to find another title for it. It's too pretentious a title, and I recognize that. But I've sort of been stuck with it. I haven't found a better title because I actually ended up writing the first draft of this on the back of a program at the symphony at the intermission. They weren't playing a nocturne that night, but the program notes talked about one of Chopin's nocturnes, and it got me thinking about waking up in the night, which is something that I do a lot of. Nocturne. The stoplight down the street blurs in the rain, bleeds into the gutters, the night sky. At the far turn of the river, a freight train follows its own faint clatter, drifting back here into the half-open window. I'm an old man whose body has gulled him again, dragging me to the bathroom to pee, and, peeless, to this window on the night. I raise the sash, put my face out into the cold rain. Somewhere beyond my line of sight, a murder is made. Children sleep on a street corner. A young woman dies in a broken automobile. Downstairs, I make coffee in the half-light and take my newspaper onto the glassed-in porch, facing east. Not reading, just sitting, seeking on the horizon some suggestion of grace in a breaking day. Another poem that I wanted to read today is called Crossing Laurel Run. And since my wife and I moved out here, we've spent a lot of time out in the Laurel Highlands and gotten to know that country and gotten to love it a lot. We knew so little about western Pennsylvania when we came out here, but we just have found the topography and the mountains and the rivers and the valleys extraordinary. And so this poem touches somewhat on that. But really, as much as anything, it's a poem about love. And it's a poem about how very difficult love is, how tough it is, how sad it can be, and also how powerful it can be. Crossing Laurel Run. Climbing the arc of the high pasture hill in 6 inches of new, wet snow, we track through a stubble of the season's last cut of hay, our boot prints puddling with dark water. Two old oaks are down with ice in the branches. As we cross Laurel Run, we hear a cracking and turn back to see a towering poplar fall dead with the weight. In the evening, together by the wood stove, we sit in silence. I stare at the page number in my book. Your needles clack for a moment, then fall still. I see your face, eyes closed, skin white, lips thin and compressed. Tighten and shift in the pulsing red glow of the fire. I could tell you what I've lost, that it is the same as what you've lost. And then we would fight again, our struggle to move past the truth, to find a way to lend the greater weight to hope. I put a hand on your arm. You put a hand on my hand. Isn't there something that we might understand, something we could know, in order to know what to say to each other? You would say there is nothing to say. And I know there is this, perhaps only this. We must hold each other in the incandescence of our own arc until the coming of the ice. Uh, another poem that relates to the land in western Pennsylvania is called Water Moving on the Land. And it also comes out of the very deep appreciation I've gotten for the beauty of the land and the water in western Pennsylvania. And it's a tough poem, and it's kind of harsh, which I'm afraid can be characteristic of a lot of my poetry, that it can be kind of tough and harsh. But it's I think ultimately by the end of the poem a celebration of the beauty of water and land. Water moving on the land. Thin rivulet fed by a ragged blanket of snow on the hillock behind the barn, resinous from pine needles that cushion its delicate passage to a dirt road ditch, turns, slips now through the low pasture into Laurel Run, then White Oak to a roaring Loyalhanna Creek, compounding at the confluence of the Conemaugh into the Kiski and Allegheny, the Ohio and wide brown Mississippi. Rust-red acid mine drainage soaking through shale and black loam into a thin stream of failed septic effluent, mixes with murky fertilizer-laden Kiski waters, yellow eddy foam of Ohio Valley sewer flux, cans and plastics and turds and rubbers all bobbing gaily on a frothy current of industrial excreta. By the time the broad Mississippi has delivered this brew to the Gulf, it is diluted by such a flow of mighty North American waters that many of the fishes are merely stunned. I wanted to do one other poem that's sort of a nature poem, but from a different part of the country. I've spent a lot of time in the summers in New England on Cape Cod, and my wife and I still go up there almost every summer. And so this also comes out of my feeling for a landscape, but a very different landscape than the one here in western Pennsylvania. This is called Grand Army of the Salt Marsh. 200 tiny crabs advance before my feet. Step left, phalanx right. Step right, phalanx left. Hardened corps of veterans crossing the salt flats to my command. Sitting later in the sand beside the channel, my boys surprise me, creeping up clicking behind, quietly flanking left and right, a few outliers skittering nervously beyond the fringes. Are they here for further orders? Or come in the hope their captain will succumb to the wind and tide? Occasion for a battalion feast, claws clattering wildly, waving in the air. We rest here in this uneasy truce, so common to commander and troop, observed from across the channel by a laconic trio of snowy egrets, listening together to the wind riffle the eelgrass at water's edge.
If you've just tuned in, you're listening to Prosody. I'm Jan Beatty, and my guest tonight is the poet Maxwell King. Max, I wanted to ask you about the compression in your lines. There's not a lot of what I would call air in your poetry. It's pretty thick and dense, and it seems to me that's related to a love of language. Can you talk about how your poems end up in this form?
Well, I'm so pleased to hear you say that, because I so often feel as if there is too much extra, too much air, too many words that aren't necessary. And one of the things that I think I enjoy the very most about writing poetry is rewriting poetry, is coming back to it again and again, and trying to boil it down, sometimes adding, but more often than not just stripping, and trying to get the language to as spare a place as possible. I also have a bad habit of loving big words, and so I sort of fight with myself sometimes about that. But it's one way in which I think my journalistic training probably was useful. You can learn a lot of bad habits as a journalist, certainly, and a lot of bad habits in writing as a journalist. But one of the pressures on journalism is to tighten things up. And so that was something I spent years doing on other people's prose as an editor. And as I said, it's one of the things I really like best about writing. Very often, and I think this is true for a lot of other people who I've talked to, who I know, who write poetry, very often the first draft will be scattered and loose and flowing and full of a lot of words that are extraneous and even thoughts that are extraneous. And I like trying to let a first draft really run, although sometimes I have to work against my training as a journalist to do that. Mm-hmm. And then spend time with a poem over several days, coming back to it maybe once a day for a week, and then put it away for a couple of weeks, mm-hmm. and come back a month later. And 75 or 80% of what I'm doing when I come back to it is trying to strip it down and compress it and mm-hmm. and take the air out.
Okay. Well, yeah, that's working then, because, yeah, I don't feel a lot of extra movement. Since you mentioned the journalist, 30 years of experience editing the Philadelphia Inquirer, or at least part of that as editor, there is a lot of noticing in your work, you know, like what is seen, you know, and a lot of it has sort of a factual feeling, like this is what was there. Do you think that's directly related to your journalistic experience?
I do. I think the very best journalism is a mix of observation and explication. And what we always taught writers at the Philadelphia Inquirer was so important was to, when they're out reporting, to gather 10 times or 20 times as much detail as they'll ever use in their story, because it's the detail and the ability to choose among different details that enriches the writing. And so the best journalism, I think, has great detail in the narrative, mm-hmm. and great explication. I mean, good journalism should do more than just tell you what happened.
Right.
It should explain to you what it means and what right. its import is. What I always wrestle with in writing poetry is that I fall in I work hard to get the detail, but then I fall into the explication.
Right, right. You don't want that.
Yes, yeah. And I always find in my first drafts that there'll be big chunks of explication. Sometimes I can save a phrase, mm-hmm. or a piece, mm-hmm. of that explication, and it'll fit and it'll work. But I have to work hard with myself to just leave it. At the detail and the richness of the narrative material.
Okay, how about more poems then?
Okie doke. In the time that my wife and I have spent out in the Laurel Highlands that I mentioned, we rented a house out there for a couple of years and just love the landscape and the mountains, and we've since bought a piece of land out there and plan to. Finish building a house out there and spend some weekends out there. And one of the things we've encountered is the extraordinary number of deer there are in Pennsylvania. And the next couple of poems, or at least the next one poem, comes out of that. There are three poems I have here that I might read that relate to deers and deer season and that stuff. This one is called In the Meadow Grass. Unrelenting rain sweeps the fields, sheets of water that unfold before the wind, flattening the meadow grass, soaking the earth. Dogs restless and sullen, starting at each thunderclap, reading each other's eyes. Late in the day they rattle the door, barking to be let out, sprinting then around the springhouse into a stand of hickory above the barn, chasing a fawn. A week later, jaunty and tumbling together in sunlight, have they no recollection of these things? Coming down from the high pasture hill to the fence line just above Laurel Run, we find the fawn lying in the flattened meadow grass, barbed wire between her and the water, foreleg broken and dangling, eyes already taken by the crows. I might as well just plunge right in and do the next one, which is just as bleak, by the way. I'm sorry to have to tell you. And it's on the same sort of a topic. It's called Doe Season. A spattering of frozen blood in the snow, granulated red pebbles, tracks the right side of the path of the wounded deer. At the barbed wire, a wide flinging arc of red blood pebbles, tufts of brown fur dangling from the fence. Down a gully just off White Oak Run, a pool of red and a pile of blue guts still steaming in the December air. Across the creek in the woods along Powder Mill Ridge, we can see two fawns moving slowly through the naked trees. That evening, we take a beef pot roast out of its plastic, arrange it in a pan with carrots and onions and potatoes, and into the oven for supper. Then sit silently together at the kitchen table, staring at the oven door. A lot of the people who live out in that part of the state almost have a love-hate relationship with the deer, because there's so many deer and they do so much damage to crops and to people's gardens. But I find the sort of fierce quality of deer hunting season to be almost terrifying. Another poem that I wanted to read comes out of a period a couple years ago when my father was dying, and right after he died. And I wrote, I wrote six or seven poems about that. I'm only going to read one. But what was so interesting to me, my father was almost 90, and he knew he was terminally ill, and he was very accepting of the fact that he'd had a great and full life, and that it was okay to be dying. And he was really quite masterful. He pulled all his children and his family around together and talked to each one of them, and then just within a couple of days slipped away and died. And so I thought, really, because he lived such a long life and a good life, and his death was a good death, that it wouldn't be something that troubled me. But that's not the way it is. When a parent dies, it's a big event. It's a transition point for you as an individual as well. And so I did end up thinking a lot about him. I ended up often picking up the phone and starting to dial it to call him and talk to him, and wrote a number of poems. And I like this poem. It's unpublished, but I wanted to read it. It's called Ghost. He surprised me first with a gesture, my gesture, a way of turning my head, raising my hand that was his. And then a face, the image of me in a mirror carrying the implication of him. His hard eyes and skeptical brow, a sardonical smile, a stance, a way of receiving the world. This chimera shadowed onto me. Now that I am looking for him where he no longer can be found, I discover him only in myself. He has not been long dead, and my impulse to connect is rewarded with these few details, pieces of my father just now retrieved in myself. And so I become one of those old men I see riding around alone in cars, conversing with themselves. I thought I'd also read you one of the most recent poems that I've read, which is probably, in fact, I'm sure, hasn't fully gone through that boiling down process. I've got some more boiling down to do. But I kind of liked it. I like it a lot. I think that's typical that you really like that the most recent poem that you wrote. And I like this one a lot, even though I do recognize that it's got some more polishing to be done. It's called simply Up. In my bedroom, the ceiling takes a roof angle slant upward toward the top of the Ursa Minor constellation and features a deep skylight high above and just a few degrees to the northwest of my head on the pillow. When I awake at 3 a.m., this broad rectangle often holds three stars, two bright and one a juddering twinkle at the upper skylight edge. By 4, a fourth star, dimmer and distant, has come into the lower quadrant of the box. Sometimes the whole frame is filled with snowflakes, a corner blowing clear and then filling in fresh with white powder. Other nights, the pane is the streaked blur of falling rain, a muted drum roll of drops playing softly overhead. When I die, I would like to lie dying on this wide bed, looking up to the depth of sky aloft, clear-headed about the rigid rectangle borders of my place in this vast, explosive universe, ready to float through the box and take the hands of clouds, riding up and under the familiar group of stars anchoring my firmament. I may look back down to the rectangle, the slanted roof, my car parked in the driveway, and wonder why I held on so very long.
If you've just tuned in, you're listening to Prosody. I'm Jan Beatty, and my guest tonight is the poet Maxwell King, reading from his manuscript In Progress. I want to ask you about the sense of what I think of as battle in your work. When you remarked earlier that the fierce quality of deer hunting was terrifying to you, I thought you were going to say the fierce quality of deer hunting was exhilarating. And so from the poems, I guess, I was thinking, because there's often this battle between the appearances of things and how they are, between the unnatural world and the world of civilization. So can you talk about that struggle, which I don't see as bleak, but it's compelling?
Well, it seems sometimes bleak, and I worry really sometimes that it makes too much of my poetry too bleak.
Why is that a problem? I don't see your poetry as bleak at all, but
well, I'm glad to hear that. You hear the theme of death in an awful lot of my poetry, and the struggle that you're talking about is in part, I think, the struggle between life and death, between order and disorder, between purpose and chaos, all those things that are, you know, so central to how any of us lives our lives. And you're absolutely right, Jan, that in addition to finding the struggle ominous or bleak or even sometimes terrifying, I find it fascinating and I love it. And so I love exploring it and writing about it. I think, although I do describe it, in many different ways, life and death, order and disorder, it's sort of it's the struggle of life. It's what we all get up to every day, and it's the peaks and valleys of living life, and trying to explore it. And trying to steer away from exploring it in theoretical ways, but explore it in real, pithy ways is what gives me so much pleasure in writing poetry.
Okay, yeah, that rings true to me. The red pebbles of frozen blood. I mean, if you're going to write that, you're in it, and I think that's working. And certainly, I guess there are people out there who don't want to hear more dark poetry, but. But I really question whether they want to hear poetry then. So, yeah. So we'll give them some more bleak, dark poetry here. So we have time for a few more poems then.
Well, good. I wanted, if nothing else, for a departure from from the darkness to read another poem about love. This one is called Stone Comfort. The glass panes in the French doors are so perfectly clean, I can see each petal of the zinnias across the terrace. Cream-colored paint on the mullions, rose and green of the Persian rug, dark sheen polished to a glowing shadow of the mahogany chairs. Do you want my love? Do you want anything of us? Or just to sit in the early morning sun, drinking Barry's tea, eating toast with English marmalade? And turning back to the country again, a poem sort of about happenstance more than anything else. This one is called Rock Time. Edge of the schist gone crumbly, fractured and seamed from a Cenozoic collision of worlds that drove it up to the sky, now sloppy and granulated through 6 days' rain and a mudslide up the ridge. This mess gives way at 3:11 p.m., dropping the boulder that had perched there since Charlemagne down to the bed of Loyal Hannah Creek, 60 feet from my crossing. A miniature tsunami rolling upstream and over my boot tops, soaking my wool socks, confirming my faith in the right arc of the heavens. And another poem I brought along that I wrote about a year and a half ago. It wasn't that long after my father died, and it's a poem that I guess the best way to put it is it involves thinking about my mother. And it's a poem I really struggled with, and I don't think it's finished, but I like it, and I like what it says. So it's called December. Her stooped figure is a gray icon on the vast white plain of the meadow down to the barnyard. She makes a note to tell the real estate man about the secret path to the salt marsh and where they covered the old cistern in the basement. Getting ready now, giving her possessions away, one by one, week by week, muttering, puttering her plans as plain and relentless as the clock on the wall. Her hair is a wave that breaks across her brow with the wind. Her eyes, the incandescence of coal fire as she reads the life of Odysseus to a great-grandson. And when the school buses move again in September, she feels the same girlish thrill of anxiety that first came over her at the end of some summer 80 years ago. Now, all light and air, like sun across water, just before dark.
Okay, that's all we have time for. Thank you so much for being here.
Thank you very much, Jan.
It's the poetry of Maxwell King. You've been listening to Prosody, WYEP's weekly show featuring the work of poets and writers. Writers appearing on Prosody also have their work showcased in Chapter and Verse, a biweekly feature in Pittsburgh City Paper, the Arts Entertainment News Weekly, published every Wednesday. Prosody is produced by Jan Beatty and Ellen Wadey. Sound engineers are Joseph Wilk and Joel Grimes. Please tune in every Tuesday night at 7 for Prosody, radio made possible with member support, 91.3 WYEP.